Our thoughts this morning are entitled Bible Orienteering. And how many of you know what the term orienteering means? So were you in the military or in the Boy Scouts? Yeah, if you were in the Boy Scouts, there is actually an orienteering merit badge, which I used to teach. And I was impressed as I started to look at Bible study and specifically with chronology, the wonderful parallels. And so we're going to kind of explore that today in our thoughts on Bible orienteering. You know, when we talk about maps, the process of building maps is called cartography. And using a map to get to destination is actually called orienteering. And so as I look around the room, how many of you out there are cartographers when it comes to the Bible, and how many are orienteers? Well, almost all of us are orienteers. So we read and understand, but very few of us are the ones that actually develop the map. And map orienteering uses symbols, directions, distances, and waypoints. And Bible orienteering uses symbols, directions, distances, and waypoints. This is what kind of intrigued me when I first started this study. And I said, well, you know, there's such a wonderful correlation that we can all use that helps us understand Bible chronology specifically. So what we're showing here is there's a correlation between map orienteering and when we actually look at chronology in the Bible. And it corresponds so nicely that it's, you know, a little beyond just coincidence. And when we talk about, if I was to teach you an orienteering class, and as I said, I used to teach this merit badge, the first three things that you have to understand before you can even start is scope, scale, and symbols. Those three things. If you don't understand scope, scale, and symbols, you look at the map, and even if you have the other skills, it doesn't mean anything. So these are the prerequisites. So if we look at map scope, we look at this map, and we've got a map of the Persian Empire, and you see the scope of it. So it's basically the Middle East, but it doesn't go extensively into Europe, doesn't go into Africa, doesn't go into Eastern Asia. The next thing that we would look at, that you have to understand before the map makes any sense, is the scale. And this is, we don't use maps that much anymore, right? We all have GPSs now, but when we did have maps, we had a scale, and remember it was in kilometers, and it was in feet, and it was miles. So it kind of gave you the scale to tell you how to translate what you're seeing into a unit of work. And typically on a topographical map, the scale will be each square in the quadrangle will be 1 square mile. So you kind of figure out how far is it. And so the scale is very important, and you have to understand that scale. So if you're European, you're going to think in kilometers, and if you're from the U.S., you'll think in miles, okay? And then you have to understand the symbols on the map, because if you don't understand the symbols, you're looking at a whole lot of nothing. So things on a regular map would be like whether it's a paved road or an off-road, whether it's a green space with parking, restrooms, all of these things that we see in a scale. And then the next things you have to understand in orienteering, once you understand, so now you've kind of learned the language, and then you have to have, for navigating, you have to have a starting and an ending point. You have to have an orientation, which direction you're going to go. Along the way, you have waypoints, because one of the things you do in orienteering, and one of the skills we teach is, well, there should be a swamp coming up on the left in a mile. And if you come up on a swamp and it's on the right, well, something's wrong. You need to correct. So all along the way, we're constantly correcting and validating where we're going. Those are waypoints. And then when you get to the end point, you get the realization that you're there, right? So you arrived here. Probably most of you had a GPS that taught you how to get through this maze of little side streets here to get to this destination. And then you arrived at your destination, and Siri or whoever the voice was said, "You have arrived at your destination." Now, in order to begin orienteering, you have to know where you're starting from and where you're finishing from. And starting seems like a duh to us today because, of course, the GPS says you are here. But if you were orienteering, so you're planning to go on a camp out and you're going to hike from point A to B, you've got to know where's the trailhead and where am I going to. The next thing you do is, which is our GPSs do automatically, is they orient the map. And what that means is normally a map is a north-up orientation. And what you have to do is you have to turn the map so that the map points the same way the road you're going down or the trail or the river. So you orienteer it, and now what appears on the map on the left is on the left, and what's on the right is on the right. What's ahead of you is ahead, and what's behind is behind. So that's called orienting your map, and that's the nature or the origin of the term orienteering. So typically what Boy Scouts do is we give them an orienteering course where they have to beeline and find certain marks, and then when they get to this mark, the big pine tree, they turn left, and then they go to the rock over here, and there'll be a little stash, and then they turn right. And we give them directions, and ultimately they get to the finish point. The same way in the military, by the way. The military also teaches this skill. So along the way, we have waypoints. And so if we're hiking up this mountain, and we're expecting we should see the big peaks on the left, the big peaks should be on the left. And if we find out they're on the right, we know, well, we're turned too far to the left. We must have missed something. So along the way, we constantly validate our route. And you notice on your GPS, it'll tell you what all the side roads are. So you know with certainty now, okay, I just crossed 12 Mile Road. And now I'm the next road, they'll tell you what it is, okay? So the GPS is doing all this for you. And then finally, we have the realization when we arrive. And as I'll tell you some stories, we had times where the realization was not what we expected. You know, maps are not always accurate, or our expectations are not always accurate. They might be out of date, there might be new roads, or that kind of thing going on. So that's really map orienteering. So we determine the starting and end point, we orient the map, we set the expectations, we observe the progress along the way, and then we adjust for reality when we get there. Now, what about Bible orienteering? Well, we have to understand God's map. In order to understand God's map, guess what? It's the exact same process. So first we have to understand the scale. And luckily the scriptures give us the keys if we are looking carefully. And as Brother Harry says, from there on it's all just math. And it's pretty simple math. But you have to understand the keys. And this is really the reason, you know, the power of the Holy Spirit in enlightening us is really tremendous. It allows us to reconcile and to harmonize these things. And so on the scale, if we look in Numbers 14:34, it says, after the number of days in which he searched the land, even 40 days each day for a year. So we're given a little key here. And you'll notice he doesn't just repeat it once. In case you missed it, he says, ye shall bear your iniquities even 40 years. So he says it twice. And so he's confirming this, and you shall know my breach of promise. But is that the only place that this is confirmed for us? And the answer is, of course, no. So we have this correspondence, a day for a year. And he's saying this is a key. So this is part of that scale. Remember we had a scale where we went from miles to kilometers to feet? This is part of our scale. We're giving you a clue here. In Ezekiel 4:6, it says, thou shalt bear thine iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. So once again, the 40 days pops up, should be a clue. Pay attention. I have appointed thee each day for a year. So now we have two places where it confirms. It's saying this is one of the keys to the scale is a day equals a year. And then we look at the Jewish calendar, which is a solar lunar calendar. And what we mean by that is there are 12 months in the Jewish calendar, but it's adjusted periodically. So it's a lunar calendar, so they're exactly 30 days in a month, but as we all know, there's 365 and a quarter days in a year, so you get out of sync every once in a while. And what this solar lunar calendar does is every once in a while there's an extra month. But if you look at their calendars, it's 12 months times 30 days, which is 360 years. And this is a key. So we don't think in terms of our calendar. We think in terms of the calendar at the time these prophecies were made and thereafter. Because this Julian calendar came in, what was it, 600-something? The Julian calendar, or maybe it was in the 1800s. This is a relatively recent invention to help us with leap years in the calendar getting out of sync with the sun. But the solar lunar calendar is self-adjusting because of the way that it works. They look at the lunar cycles. When they see things getting out of sync, they add an extra month. That puts them back in, and then it gradually gets out again. So the key is that we have to think 12 months, 30 days, 360 years, or 360 days per year. And then we have other expressions in the scriptures, the times and the seasons, and sometimes these are used within chronology as well. And in Joshua 3:15, we have the time of the harvest. How many harvests a year was he talking about? One. So one cycle. We had the time of sowing. One. Once a year. We had the time of the first ripe grapes. Once a year. And then we have in Leviticus 25:50, shall be according to the number of years according to the time. Okay, years to time. What is time? Well, he's saying that a time is 1 year. How many days in a year? 360, according to the Jewish calendar. So you now, if you hear a time, you know it's what? The number 360, 360 years. And this is one of the keys. Now, this all sounds, you'll see how this is confirmed in the chronologies, especially with the 1260 years, because we're given it in all the different increments that show us this relationship. So it locks it in. And then we have a very special number, 1,000, in 2 Peter 3:8. But do not let this fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. So he's stating it both ways. And anytime you see things repeated, it's kind of a, okay, pay attention. I'm giving you a key, and then I'm reaffirming it right there. And that, in fact, is what's happening here in Peter. And you might say, well, that's one place where it says that. Is there any place else? And we'll say, of course. So we've got one day for 1,000 years in the sight of the Lord. So this is a special scale. This is in the sight of the Lord. And in Psalm chapter 90, verse 4, for 1,000 years in your sight, speaking of the Lord, are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. So he's giving us a scale here again. And remember, we have to understand the scales before we can even start to navigate the map. So until all these things are clear, the scale and the scope and so forth, we can't do anything. Now, this day for 1,000 years is from God's perspective. Important to note. So this is from God's perspective. So there are some very special prophecies that are from God's perspective, and they will use this scale. So when we look at Bible scale, we've got a day for a year, and consequently, there's how many days in a week? 7. So that's 7 years. And in a month? 30. So that's 30 years. And a year or a time is 360 days. This is real key. And then our supplemental scale, you know, the one at the very bottom. So supplemental scale is a day with the Lord is as 1,000. And that's key for some very big things that he talks about, like creation and some of those kinds of things. Then we look at chronology methods. And basically, when we look at the scriptures, there's chronologies that have a starting and an end point. But the end point is not known. It's done through extrapolation. And those are things like the double. And I put doubles because we're actually going to show you some reflections here where there perhaps are more than one. I think there actually are more than one. And we'll show you those. And then we have things with a starting point and a period. And as Brother Harry said, this is simple math. Once you know the starting point, you do the math and you know where you are. And so that's the 490, 1260, 1290, 1335, 2300, and 2520. And then we have starting point with a period or a cycle. And that would be things like the creative days, the harvests, and the jubilees. Now, for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to cover this middle section. And it's not because I don't want to deal with the other ones. It's because in the 3 hours that we have remaining, this is all I could do. Right, Brother Chairman? So, because of our time and also because of focus, we want to cement these concepts. So, if you've had problems understanding chronology or it's just a little bit too obscure, hopefully we're going to give you a mapping of chronology and we're going to look at, focus not so much on the numbers as the events and what their significance is. Because what's more important, the map or the reality. So let's look at our focus. We're going to look at all of these things that are in the second volume, and there's been much written about and so forth. So when we look at a topographical map, like your GPS in your car, if you looked at the data, there are longitudes and latitudes, and they go down in degrees, minutes, seconds, and fractions of a second. And that's how, with triangulation, these satellites can tell you exactly where you are on the Earth. And that's the nature of a topographical map. And that's really how they were made. Most of these maps were made by noting locations and measuring distances and angles and triangulating on the Earth. Now we have the GPS satellites 26,000 miles up. They do a triangulation based on their atomic clocks. We know the time differences. Therefore, we can figure out where we are with a high degree of accuracy now. When we talk about Bible maps, we have endpoints and numbers and distances, don't we? And so we're going to look at all these numbers. I apologize if numbers intimidate you, but I want to tell you, just like in your GPS, what's important? It's the map you're seeing on the screen, not the numbers behind it. And sometimes we focus so much on the numbers that we miss the meaning. And that's, we're going to try to focus on the meaning. But we're going to actually cover all of these. Well, I hope we're going to cover all these. So these are like GPS coordinates. They have a starting and an ending point and a distance. So just like GPS, if you did that trail, it would be longitude, latitude, and then you go a certain distance at that angle, then you put another waypoint and another waypoint. So in Bible orienteering, it corresponds so nicely. In Matthew 24:3, we're reading Rotherham. The disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what will be the sign of your presence and the conclusion or the end of the age?" And what does he say? In John 16:13, he says, "He will show you things to come." So, when we lay out a map and we plot out our route, we're looking at what we're expecting to go to, right? It's a journey through time as well as through space. And he says he's going to show you things to come. But the thing to note here, it requires both signs and times. Signs and times. And by the way, isn't that exactly what we were doing in map orienteering? We were looking at the signs. We knew where we should be going, but we were also confirming along the way the reality, the signs of where we were and what we were experiencing. So, in Bible orienteering, we determine the starting and ending point, if we can. Now, we can't always do that in repeating periods. We orient the scriptures. So we, in orienting the scriptures, really what we're talking about is discerning what the prophecy is about and then bringing in other evidence. We set expectations. We observe progress along the way. And really, when you look back at the volumes, what did the pastor do? He told us about all those events, and then a lot of the volumes are all the details about the journey and the things he saw in the French Revolution and all these things and how they were lined up with the prophecy. So we observe progress along the way, and then we finally adjust for reality. So let's look at the prophecy of the double. In Isaiah chapter 40, verse 2, it says, "Jerusalem, she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all of her sins." Well, part of the key of this is to understand what this word double means. And double is kepel, and it means to fold in half. Now, when I fold something in half and I unfold it, what do I have? Two halves. So if I tore the paper in half, what would I have? Two equal parts. And so this is key. It's not just a folding, but it's a folding in half. And therefore, that gives us a key that allows us, we're understanding the language and the context. Now we understand it's two equal halves, and that's key. And so what we find is when we're trying to find the double, there's two sides of it. There's a blessing, and we find that in Genesis 49:28. The 12 tribes of Israel, their father spake of them and blessed them. So this is the blessing that they received when they became the 12 tribes. That's the first half. What's the second half? And when we look in Matthew 23:38, unto you your house is left unto you desolate. So we had two sides. So we had the blessing here, and we had the desolation here. And now let's fold it in half and see where the middle is. Let's see what that looks like. So religious Israel's doubled. We know at Jacob's death is when the blessing to the 12 tribes went out, 1813 B.C. So if we go 1845 years forward, what do we have? Jesus' death. And we go from there, the Jews' desolation, we left them desolate, on to 1878. And what began there? Well, I think Bob's talk talked about that. Some very subtle beginnings, maybe it was Jim's, where he talked about Petah Tikva, and then the next month there was another settlement and another settlement, and he gave us a lot of the historical background on it. A very subtle beginning, wasn't it? It wasn't an in-your-face big event like the dropping of the atomic bomb. It was very subtle. So little beginnings like that, little seeds were dropped. But there was a regathering and the coming back together of those bones. And we see how nicely that divides into two periods of 1845 years. So we have religious Israel's blessing and their desolation. And the periods line up nicely, and they are in half. So this should give us a degree of assurance, a high degree of assurance, actually, that this is correct. So we're going to put those on the waypoints. And as I said, we're taking away the numbers in this part of it. So we have Jewish nationhood, spiritual favor removed, and then the Jews regathered. So we have blessing and desolation. Now let's look at another double that is secular Israel's double. So this is their secular. So starting with the same starting point when they became the 12 tribes, and then looking at when Israel was established, 1948, 3,760 years. So if we divide that in half, and if this is a double, we would divide in half, wouldn't we? We come to the year 68 A.D. And I know what you're thinking. Close, but not quite, Brother Bob. But once again, let's talk about the dispersion from the land. Little seeds are key to this. So I said to myself, what happened in 68 A.D.? So once again, we had secular Israel with an identity, and then they were dissolved. They were not a nation. Now they came back together. What happened in 68 A.D.? Well, Vespasian had campaigns down into the Holy Lands, and what was the culmination? 70 A.D. That's what we all remember. But what happened in 68 A.D.? So when we look at this, the orange-brown lines are his campaign in 67 A.D. 68 is the blue lines, and then finally 69 and into 70 goes right into the core, into Jerusalem. But what happened in 68 A.D.? Well, there was a leader that died, and we're all familiar with his name, and that was Nero. And one of the things that happened was after Nero's death, there was what? All campaigns ceased for over a month. So there was a cessation of these campaigns. They, I guess that's how they respected his bloody legacy, I suppose. But anyway, so basically the campaigns halted for about a period of a month or more. And what happened as a result? Well, if you look at the campaigns up here, this was the last time that the Jews in Jerusalem had a chance to escape. If you look here, they were boxed in the first 2 years. But when the cessation came, that was their last chance to escape. And what happened in 70 AD? Well, it's estimated Titus slaughtered 1.1 million Jews and burned Jerusalem, decimated it. But their last chance to escape was 68 AD. So this actually is a very nice beginning that lines up nicely with this Bible waypoint. So we'll go ahead and put that out there. Secular Israel has an identity, and then they are desolate down to Jewish nationhood. Let's then look at the 2,520 years. In Leviticus 26:17 and 18, it says, "And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. and they that hate you shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth you. And if you will not know for all this, hearken unto me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins. How much is the time? A year, right? How many days in a year? 360. So we do the math, the beauty of the math. 7 times 360 is 2,520 years. And how does that look? Well, if we say that the kings ended in 606 BC, that brings us right up to 1914, which is the end of Gentile dominion. And it's really recognized by historians, contemporary historians, that the right to rule changed because of the war that started at that time, 1914 on. So it's a recognized period. It lines up exactly with history, doesn't it? So that was the time of Gentile dominion, where they were under Gentile dominion, and after that, they started to come out from Gentile dominion. So we add those waypoints in. Gentile dominion down to the end of Gentile times. Now we're starting to see. You see, too often we look at the numbers and we don't look at what the significance was with regards to natural Israel. And the beauty for us is we see these things line up so beautifully and precisely that it gives us confidence. Next, we look at the 70 weeks in Daniel 9:24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon the holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end to sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Boy, that's a lot, isn't it? What does that mean? Now, once again, we don't understand the unless we understand the context and look at the symbols, we really can't understand. But first, let's look at the math. So we have 70 weeks. How many days in a, how many years in a week? 7. 490 years. And how does that work? Well, we believe that it started with the rebuilding of the walls in 454 BC, and it was described as 69 weeks down to Messiah, 29 AD. What began in 29 AD? Christ's ministry. The 70 weeks of favor, when did that end? Well, that would be 7 years later. We can add 7 weeks in, down to 36 AD. And then it talks about, in Daniel 9:27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. 1 week, 7 days. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. So what would half a week be? 3.5 years? That lines up with Christ's ministry. And what ended then? The sacrifice and oblation. So once again, because we understand the symbols, we see how this fits just perfectly. I really get excited about this. And then what else happened? During Christ's ministry, there was a time when the favor was only to the Jews. But remember, the call was left open to the Jews for about 3.5 years after that, down to 36 AD. And after that, the call was open. So it was exclusive to the Jews before then. And then after 36 AD, they had to start dealing with Gentiles. And we all know, based on Acts and Romans and some of the other, it was a time when there was a lot of misunderstandings, right? It was a new period. But the call opened up. So we see how nicely that fits in as well. From the rebuilding of Jerusalem down to exclusive favor being removed in 36 AD. Next, we look at the 2300 days. How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, 2,300 days. Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now, let's look at it. What was going to occur? Well, the daily offerings were to be broken. There was going to be a change there. And then the sanctuary was to be cleansed. What does that mean? Well, let's look. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16, we read, Know ye not that ye are the temple of God? And this was very key to understand that there was a class being developed that would become this sanctuary class. And that's what was being talked about. Let's see how this maps out as well. So when we bring up our map, we say, well, the rebuilding of Jerusalem was 454 BC. We add the 2300 years, which is what we came up with in our math. And it comes up with the grand date of 1846. And once again, we go, what happened in 1846? It says the sanctuary is going to be cleansed. Do we have an event? Once again, don't look for big things, look for little things. But the little things, if you're looking, will be very clear. So the sanctuary class would be separated. So what happened in 1846? Well, let me show you. This is the symbol today for the Evangelical Alliance. And you can look online. They're out there. Their mission is to unify all of Christianity with common doctrines and so forth. But it was founded in 1846. And so you might say to me, well, okay, that's nice, but so what? Remember, a sanctuary class, this temple of God, would be separated and pulled out. And as I looked this up, there was a couple of tenets that the church couldn't abide by, the true church. The third tenet was the unity of the Godhead and the Trinity of persons therein. And I quote, and to the true church who understood that this was, there was a Father and Son, that God gave individuals the power of the Holy Spirit, that it wasn't a separate person, that the Son had to die on the cross, and therefore, you know, if he was a diune or a triune God, he couldn't raise himself if he died. So they understood that, and they couldn't abide by number three. And then number eight, their eighth doctrine was the immortality of the soul, which denies the ransom. And so these two things during the, early Adventist movements, they couldn't really abide by. So the church could no longer stay in this alliance because these two things really violated some key doctrines, you know, to the truth. And so they couldn't deal with it anymore. They had to come out of those systems. And so we add that in. From the rebuilding of the wall down to the cleansing of the sanctuary. And now we turn to Daniel chapter 12. Remember I told you, you're going to have a whirlwind tour of chronology here. We turn to Daniel chapter 12, verse 9. Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Now this is kind of an interesting one. A number of years ago I was in Jim Parkinson's home. And he showed me a book that had was published by Eliot in 1852. And it had an interesting chronology. And it was the first one, I guess, that we found where the starting points of all these started at the same time. See, up till then, the 1260, 1290, and 1335, people that were looking at chronology put them at different starting points. But Eliot first published this in a chronology, and I saw the chart, and it said, this was later adopted by Storer, and then Barber, and then Russell. So this was the basis, because they realized when you line up the starting points, that was correct, and then you saw the fulfillment of these things. And so when we add these things, when we understand the starting point was 539 A.D., the very infancy of the beginning of set up a papacy, we go forward to 1799, 1829, and 1874. And these are dates that a lot of us hold very dearly. So let's look at each of the dates. And the 1260, I love the 1260 because this is the one, if you can't get this fact that a day for a year, that correspondence, this is the one that will cement it. Because the 1260 is shown in Revelation as 42 months. 42 times 30 is 1260. It's called times, times, and half a time. That would be 360. Times is two times, 720 and 180, that's 1260. And it's called years in Revelation as well. So here we have all the same prophecies, and this is kind of a a Rosetta Stone that shows us all these things are correct. So we had them mentioned elsewhere in the scriptures, but this connects them all together with the 1260 years and says, you understand the keys. And remember what I said? You got to understand the keys before you can read the map. So if you don't understand this, that these are valid relationships, then you're not going to understand the numbers. And if you don't have the numbers, you're not going to navigate. And what happened during this time? Papacy dominates, and the holy people are in the wilderness condition. So let's look at the 1260 years. So we say it started in 539 with the roots of papacy. We're not going to go into all the details, but you can read about Vespasian, in the Italian peninsula, it started the setup of papacy anyway. So we go forward. In 1799, what happened? The Pope died in captivity. And worse than that, it didn't allow him to appoint another Pope, which is significant. It's called the lowest point in the Catholic system by the Catholics. Because if the Pope is God's representative on earth and a man can stop from the next representative being appointed, then that's significant. It shows them to be less than they're claiming to be. And then also, in 800 AD, Charlemagne, they started to claim the papal millennium, God's kingdom, Christendom, Christ's kingdom on earth was the promise. And that ended in 1799. Very interesting. Is that just a coincidence? We think not. So we come down here and we add papal power coming in. So papacy was set up, and then papacy was really broken to the point where a thinking individual would have to question how God's representative, God's appointed representative on earth, could not only die, but a man could prevent God's will from being done on earth, the next one being set up. So this was a chink in the armor that then you started to question the whole system. Then we look at the 1290 days, and this is the abomination that maketh desolate, as we're all familiar. And in Daniel 12:9, it goes on and says, many shall be purified and made white and tried, and it says the wise shall understand. And from the time of that daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days, 1,290 days. So it's giving us, as it were, the key. And the key here is it says the wise, those that who discern these things, who search them out, will understand this. So what does this look like? Well, this looks like papacy's roots. Once again, same starting point, 1,290 days, and it goes up to 1829 A.D., and this was really the start of the Miller movement around that time. But also, this was a renaissance in Christianity. A renaissance, because what you realize is, for the first time, we had Bible aids that allowed the common man to read his Bible and to gain understanding. And so there was a tremendous, tremendous resurgence of Christianity, especially in the United States, all the way down until the Civil War. This was a time of a lot of excitement as people started to understand some of these deep Bible truths. And that was because of this revealment of all these things being translated into the common language and being available. So you had books like Strong's Concordance that were available to the common man. And so there was a gradual enlightenment that occurred during this period, and then things kind of took off. And really, we know that some of the Miller movement premises were things that, Pastor Russell early in his career picked up on, and the things that made sense and that the Holy Spirit led him to, he adopted. And so this really leapfrogged our understanding of Bible knowledge. And so we add this in, the Enlightenment. So Bible aids and the Miller movement. And a resurgence of interest in the Bible. Then we go on to the 1335 days. And at that time shall Michael stand up. Now, what does it mean? Well, if we go on to Daniel 12:12, we read, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 and 30 days. So it's talking about this 1,335 days. In Matthew, we have another thing that helps us understand what is this blessedness that's associated with Michael standing up. And you know, even in the Daniel 12:12 we read, blessed is he. And then we look at that cometh. It has to do with the Lord's presence. And it was said in Old Testament days about when he came into the city in Matthew 21:9, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. These are all little keys that help us understand. It's talking about the Lord's return to power. And so let's see what that looks like. Well, once again, starting with our starting point, 539 going forward, we come up with 1874, which is a well-beloved date amongst Bible students because we believe the Lord returned invisibly at that time. And what did he say would happen? He said that there would be those that would be watching and waiting. And who was that? That was Pastor Russell, because he started to publish just after that. He realized that the Lord had returned. I think it was 1881 when he published his premises on the nature of the Lord's return. So they were starting to see and understand. And what else came out during this time? Write the vision and make it plain. Write it upon tables. And the chart is a two-dimensional table with time and with hierarchy. And you write it down and you make it plain. And when did that at that time it would speak? So it lines up also with this time frame. So the Lord's return to power. And so there we have it. We've got our Bible waypoints. Really interesting, isn't it? You know, as we looked at this, we realized that there are prophecies for Israel, and that we've highlighted those. Jewish nationhood, Gentile dominion, rebuilding of Jerusalem, spiritual favor, exclusion, exclusive favor removed, the nation dispersed, the regathering, and so forth. These all dealt with God's miraculous timepiece, which we can see today. I mean, as you saw, we had a 1948 date in there that was a double and lines up just very nicely. But there are also prophecies for spiritual Israel. Papacy being set up and broken, enlightenment and the cleansing nature of cleansing of the sanctuary, and the Lord's return. And these only God's people would see and understand. The wise will understand. That's what the scriptures say. That's not what I say, but the scriptures say the wise will understand these things, and they will reconcile them, and they will harmonize them, and they will have a pretty good understanding of what's happening. So that's a view of God's map today, so far. Now, I know there are some other additional things. We're going with the basics here, and we think this is valid. Now, the wonderful thing is for spiritual Israel, all of these things apply, because we go back and we get really sure, because we're seeing starting and ending points for natural Israel. That gives us a lot of confidence. We see these things that are exclusively for his people, and it's to give us confidence, because we know that things will tarry. You know, the last step in our orienteering was adjusting for reality, and the pastor adjusted for reality. In the third volume, in the fourth, it said, we are free to say that the restoration of Israel has not been accomplished as rapidly as we had anticipated. Nevertheless, we should be in a waiting and expectant attitude. And he went on to say that he thought that in the next 2 or 3 years that they would become a nation. Like a lot of us, he was wildly optimistic. It was a few years later, but it did happen with absolute certainty, just as God had said. Continuing, he said, some of us were quite strongly convinced that the harvest would be ended by now, but our expectations must not be allowed to weigh anything against the facts. Adjust for reality. That's what he's saying. Just like the map. The fact that the harvest work is grandly going on is not ended by any means. He said, we imagine that the harvest work of gathering the church would be accomplished before the end of the Gentile times, but nothing in the Bible said so. Our thought was purely by inference. And this is a natural thing, by the way, because we always try to apply things in our day. That's natural. And so the pastor was admitting, well, we thought the harvest would be done right now, but he's correcting his thought and saying that was an inference. And an inference, he's saying, well, I wasn't right in that. Continued, he said, in fact, the kingdom might be here in a year or two, possibly more. The kingdom will be fully set up And it's not disappointing because the Lord's people are finding so many opportunities for service that their hands, hearts, and heads will be fully engaged laboring on this side of the veil. And this would apply even down to our day, isn't it? We're fully engaged. Brother Rick is going, you still go to Myanmar and Africa and India, and we have brethren going to South America and to Africa, all over the world, the Philippines. So what would the pastor say today? And here's the point. As we approach the destination, we have this map. But what's more important, the map or the reality? You know, we're told, and we have to examine ourselves and look at these assumptions. You know, there were a lot of assumptions made. Some have come to full fruition. Some were delayed, and we see historically have occurred. And some don't seem to have appeared quite yet. We're told in Luke 21:28, and when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your head, for your redemption draweth nigh. It's right at the door, isn't it? So what have we learned along the way? Well, we've learned that when we see these deep things, and our manna text this morning was on the strong meat. I mean, this is not a thing for infants to understand, but we see that these are deep things. It bolsters our faith. It confirms that we are seeing the vision correctly. You know, it's almost like a mathematical model where you do a proof and then you see what reconciles. And I can reconcile it several ways, so I know with confidence that it's true. It gives us the surety of God's promises that they will come true. We see many of the facets of his plans that the world is blind to. And we see how close we are to the full establishment of the kingdom. And what should that do for it? It should give us a sense of urgency that time is short. So when are we? Not where are we. When are we? Well, we're told in Romans 8:19, for the earnest expectation of the creation waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of men, sons of God. What's he saying? God's waiting on you and he's waiting on me. Get to work. There's still work to be done. This gospel of the kingdom hasn't gone out to all the corners of the world. Not yet. Almost. But not quite yet. And that's our responsibility. So it's a call to action. Do you have a sense of urgency in your life? You should. And that's a tough thing to maintain over time, isn't it? But he's saying it's even at the door. Where are we? I can tell you with certainty we are one day closer to the establishment of the kingdom, the full establishment of the kingdom. But I can't tell you when. Because if he told us, I'd get a little bit lazy. I'd say, well, that's 5 years out, and I got a little time to... No, we should have a sense of urgency. We really appreciate that. That he's showing us all these things, and he's saying, not quite yet. You've got work to do. So get to it. We appreciate our Heavenly Father, for from him and through him and to him are all things. To God be the glory forever. Amen.